2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 234, All Alike Unto God, How Racism Affects Identity in the Church and Community, a panel discussion featuring Margaret Toscano, Natalie Palmer Shepherd, Sarah Smith, Sandra Plazas, and Connie Taholo.
Important that it's the Mormon Women's Forum, a feminist group, that wants to talk about this problem of race and women, because like most of American feminism, Mormon feminism has largely belonged to white women. And I think that there's a problem with this. Now, on the one hand, feminism is a natural companion of race issues, or at least it should be, because I see the essence of feminism as a critique of power, as a critique of privilege and hierarchy. And we can't talk about racism unless we're willing to question and critique hierarchy. But of course, Mormon feminism, like American feminism, white American feminism, has participated in racism too. And so I want to begin by saying that I don't think we can address this issue unless all of us are willing to admit that we have been racist and that we participate in racist systems. Darren Smith, in talking about race, relied heavily on what is now called whiteness theory. And I want to do two things as I'm kind of setting up our issue. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about whiteness theory, and then I want to go to the theme that's in our title, which is taken from the Book of Mormon, and this question of, are all alike unto God? And so first I want to talk a little bit about whiteness theory. And this has been a very important part of race theory in academia because, again, it locates one of the main issues of racism as in whiteness itself. Those of us who are white have been able to ignore the issue of race, like American feminism, because being white, part of what it means to be white, is to be privileged. And you can't ignore race unless you're privileged. That's part of the privilege, is that you don't have to deal with race issues. I believe firmly, and Darren said this yesterday, that discussions about race should not be the burden of blacks or Hispanics or other minorities. It should be all of our burden, because all of us participate in the system that does this. Now, one of the main ideas of whiteness theory is that that race is a social construction. Now, most of us, when we think about race, we think about skin color, about biology. That's sort of the typical American way of approaching this. Whiteness theory says that all race is social construct. And as part of this, I mean, I think it's very interesting that we often think of as people of color have race, whites don't. We're normal, we're neutral, right? That's part of privilege, is assuming that what we are is normal. And whiteness theory says is that there's no neutral position. Everybody has color. And to not talk about it is to be colorblind, and this is one of the ways that we perpetuate the oppression and the privilege. Whites are assumed to be the norm. And of course, this is not true. It shouldn't be true. Whiteness, then, is not simply color. It is social privilege and control of what is normal. Now, just to give you a quick example of how you can kind of see whiteness as privilege in a social construct, even our idea of what counts as a race has changed over the years. My last name, Toscano, comes from my husband, whose family are all Sicilian. When they immigrated to this country in the early part of the 20th century, Italians, especially southern Italians from Sicily, were not considered whites. And in fact, even my mother-in-law, Paul's mother, never thought of herself as a white woman. It's true that she had very dark, absolutely gorgeous olive skin. But she never thought of herself as a white person. Now, as Italian Americans have been sort of melted into this American pot, the idea of Italian as a race has more or less disappeared. I mean, Paul, unlike his mother, has always thought of himself as very much American. So what is a race can change because it is a social construct. One of the questions that I'm going to pose, and I'm not going to give a definitive answer to, but I think is important, is how do we construct whiteness in the church? And I'm just going to throw out an idea, but I'd like you to think about this. I think that whiteness in the church is very connected to the ethnicity of English and Scandinavian, Northern European ancestry. And I see, in fact, some of my own husband's problems in the church is stemming from that he was never considered a white man. Now, I want to go from that to the idea of our theme of are all alike unto God. And in order to do this, I want to talk about, just quickly, two paradoxes that I see that the Book of Mormon makes us confront. One of them is the issue of racism and equality, sort of what is racism, what is equality, and the other is the paradox of likeness and difference. Now, I want to start out with the first. In order for us to face our racism in the church, one of the things I think we have to face is that the Book of Mormon has a lot of racism in it. In the Book of Mormon, darkness is equated with curse. And blessing or goodness is equated with whiteness. And even, you know, with some of our attempts to kind of sanitize the language, I think that that is still very much a part of the text. On the other hand, and this is one of the things I love about religious texts sometimes, or any text, is that there's often subtexts that subvert some of the main messages. The Book of Mormon, besides being having racism in it, also has some of the strongest statements on equality in it. And I just want to read you part of the statement from 2 Nephi. Better look at my time here. From 2 Nephi, chapter 26, verses 28 to 33, which is part of our theme. Let me read. Hath the Lord commanded any that they should not partake of his goodness? Behold, I say unto you, nay, but all men are privileged. Of course, there is sexism here, right? The one like unto the other, and none are forbidden. Then skipping down a few verses, he inviteth them all to come unto him and partake of his goodness. And he denieth none that come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female. And he remembereth the heathen, and all are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile. It's a beautiful scripture for this expansive openness. Now, I want to just quickly end with one more paradox, though, and that is that most of us, I think, you know, if we at least have the ideal of equality, and yet the question arises, how can we have equality and still promote difference? One of the ideas that I do resist in the Book of Mormon is the idea of somehow, if we're all righteous, we're going to all turn white. I've always been bothered by this because I don't know, it just seems really horrible. Not only because it's racist, because it seems boring as well. I hope, my view of the celestial kingdom is that we're going to have lots of diversity, that we're going to have lots of differences, and that's part of what would make the celestial kingdom exciting. I don't want heaven to be a place where we are all the same, where we all have white skin, where we all wear white robes, where we all have white hair, and where we all wear those same ugly white temple slippers. In my heaven, differences will abound, but we will be alike in dignity and value. Finally, while Heavenly Father may be a white man, I don't believe Heavenly Mother is. I don't know what shade of brown or black she is, but I see her as a figure who both shatters our categories of power at the same time she welcomes all of her children into her warm embrace. Now, let me introduce our panelists. I'm very excited about these women who have agreed to participate. I want to also tell you that disregard a lot of what you see on the program. We had to do a lot of last-minute changes, and I really appreciate these women's willingness to come and talk about their experience. And so I'm going to introduce them in the order that they are going to speak to you. So you'll have to hold up your hand because you're not sitting in order. So we're going to begin with Sarah Smith, who's right there. Sarah, by the way, is also on the board of the Mormon Women's Forum, and she's been a wonderful help there. Sarah grew up in San Francisco and Logan. She has a BS from Utah State in special education with minors in art and music. She has a master's from BYU in counseling psychology with a minor in English composition. She is a mental health therapist. She works with child abuse prevention, academic and career counseling, and court-ordered youth at risk. She is a fantastic writer. She's published a lot of essays in local publications, and in fact, she even for a time had a sex advice column. She's the mother of three grown sons, and she remarried in the last year to an old friend. I thought that was wonderful. Sandra, are we going to have you go second? Sandra will be second. Sandra was originally from Colombia, and she has been in this country for 11 years. While she was in Colombia, she did a degree in journalism and told me that I probably couldn't pronounce the name of the university, and it's true. Sandra Plazas. Did I give you your last name? Plazas? Did I say that it right at all? Sandra is both an owner and also a reporter for the Mundo Hispano, which is a local newspaper, mostly in Spanish, that deals with Hispanic issues in the community. She is also a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, and she is the mother of a 9-year-old boy and a 6-year-old girl. Our next speaker will be Lonnie, who's on the end. Hi, Lonnie. Never met you, but talked to you. And correct my pronunciation of your last name. Lonnie Toholo? Toholo, okay. Lonnie was born in Hawaii, and she did her undergraduate work at BYU. She did her master's of social work at the University of Utah, and she has worked with the DCFS, the Division of Child and Family Services, for the state of Utah since 1987, and she deals with families in foster care. She's also a member of the National Advisory Board for the American Association for Family Group Decision Making. And she works with MANA, which is a group that deals with Pacific Island youth who are having problems. Finally, our last speaker will be Natalie, right here, Natalie Palmer Shepherd, who grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. Natalie graduated in psychology with minors in sociology and criminology from the University of Utah. She's also a social worker for the Child Protective Services with DCFS, and her goal is to keep children safe. I think it's interesting that 3 out of our 4 panelists deal with children's issues. She was married in 1991, and she and her husband have 7 children combined. Natalie has been an activist in black issues in the LDS community since the 1970s, and she's part of the Genesis Group, which is a group, I think they meet monthly, Natalie, that tries to help blacks feel part of the church and address their issues, and also families of mixed race. She's been the Relief Society of that organization, and now is what again, Natalie? The sort of the mission person director. Anyway, I want to turn the time over to them. After each of them presents her views, we hope to have a few minutes at the end for some questions and interaction with you as an audience.
I'm very happy to be here, and I'm happy for your presence and your interest in this subject. Before sixth grade, I lived in San Francisco, a city of racial diversity, especially of Asians, as you all probably know. Like any child, I went to school concerned mainly whether my lunch was going to be peanut butter or bologna, or if I was going to walk home with a cute boy in fifth grade. Because in my family, we were treated more like monkeys, you know, the old see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil, I was looking for attention from anyone. Kids, teachers, monkeys, had they been around. Little did I know that when we moved to Utah, attention was going to become something dreaded. Picture a young girl in sixth grade playing obliviously at recess, her second week in a strange school, strange town, strange state. A fat boy begins calling her names, something like Ching Chong or So. She stares at the fat boy, wondering why he was mimicking things at her. Sing-songy sounds foreign to her as Utah was. To her knowledge, this incident was her introduction to racism. From then on, as the teasing continued, she slowly became ashamed of herself and of the color of her race. All through junior high school and high school, kids, mostly boys if I recall correctly, shouted racial slurs at me in the hallways between classes, lunchroom, pep rallies. Even elementary grade kids from the yellow school buses shouted out racial slurs as I walked home from school. Logan, Utah, mostly white and Mormon, felt merciless. I had no friends and no mentors. That, coupled by a mother who complained every day what a bad job I did on some task, or could not look prettier, or could not be smarter than so-and-so, generated a sense of inferiority, as you can well imagine. To fit in somewhere, I started to go to the Mormon church that was a block away, and I even attended seminary classes. In fact, it was an honor to give one of the speeches at our high school seminary graduation. However, despite my efforts to fit in, kids still avoided me. Even at Utah State University, where I earned a bachelor's degree, there was racial alienation, believe it or not. In front of the class, I recall one professor who said, "I just wasn't going to make it if I didn't get some confidence." To make a long story short, thanks to personal men who have treated me with love and respect, I gradually through the years developed a sense of worth, and I learned to respect both my race and gender. It's been a long, arduous process, and there are relapses of self-doubt. But I learned that I wasn't ugly, that I had some talents, and that I wasn't just another brainless chink. I slowly learned I was good as everyone else. Just for fun, I looked up in the dictionary definition of racism. Animosity toward other races, the belief that some races are inherently superior or inferior. In 1982, President Spencer W. Kimball said, "We do wish that there would be no racial prejudice. Racial prejudice is of the devil. There is no place for it in the gospel of Jesus Christ. You must teach your people to overcome their prejudices. They should be brothers, to worship together and to work together and to play together." With this background, I like to cite some incidents that seem racially prejudicial, both church-specific and perhaps Utah-only specific. My goals here are twofold. First, to shed a little more awareness to what racial exclusion is like in the church, and second, that how we act, even a subtle glance, affects how others feel. Incident. After a homemaking meeting, now called enrichment meetings, an Asian woman told her white husband that she wished she was white. Apparently, during that same meeting and other meetings too, members had excluded her in their conversation. She, like me, often feels like an outsider in the church, and like her, I have wanted to be white, and male too, by the way. Called to be a counselor in the primary presidency some years ago, the president barely acknowledged my presence. She avoided greeting me or making eye contact when she spoke. To this day, it is a wonder to me that we accomplished anything. A decade and a half later, when I see this woman at a public place, she still does not make eye contact or greet me. A particularly hurtful experience, published in Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, chronicles an incident where a bishop and a counselor in his stake presidency informed my son that they did not want me to speak at his missionary farewell. No ecclesiastical reason was given. I was stunned, as I had spoken at my other two sons' farewells. So I made an appointment with the stake president, who told me that he unequivocally supported this bishop. Therefore, he made no effort to ask this bishop why I was barred from speaking, despite his assertion that there was no church policy prohibiting my speaking in sacrament meeting. If not racial, there certainly was prejudice of some kind. Hurt and feeling utterly helpless, I wrote a 5-page letter to President Hinckley, but by the time there was a response, and by the way, his method of handling my problem would not have helped me, my son's farewell was over. This bishop is still the Dean of Religious Education at BYU, and the counselor in the state presidency with whom he collaborated on this decision is the son of a prominent general authority. As a side note, in a BYU publication, these two gentlemen were cited for anti-Semitism, allegedly found in a book they had written together. another incident. When a racially mixed couple had their first child, the father's grandmother said, "Oh, isn't it wonderful? You can see the curse of the Lamanites leaving because his skin is white." Of African-American basketball players, a friend's uncle, an active member, said, "Them, forgive me for using the N-word, them nigger boys are dumber than two Brocks, but they sure can play basketball." A close friend shared this story with me. His father was in a store with his cousin waiting for service and noticed that an African-American was being passed by. When the store clerk turned to my friend's father, he said, "I believe this gentleman was here first." Sometime later, at a family gathering, this cousin saw my friend's father, and across the room where other family members can hear, said, "Here comes the nigger lover." This cousin was an active member. Another incident. An MTC teacher told one of his former students who was planning to ask a Japanese woman to marry him, "You can have as many Japanese friends as you want, but you don't want to marry one. You just don't want to marry one." I have been followed in stores largely employed by members like the former ZCMI, Nordstrom's, University Mall stores in Orem, and BYU bookstore. And no, I did not imagine this. When a flood killed a number of people in Mexico, I was told that a group of white male members said this among themselves. "They breed so fast anyway. They breed like rats." At least the flood was in a South American country and not in North America. Among themselves, I hear that white members tell racist jokes and use words like spick, jap, chink. I also learn that some members call white trash and white guys who like hip-hop and black culture wiggers. Did you know this? I didn't. At a missionary reunion, his former AP, assistant to the mission president, said this to a fellow missionary who had married a Korean woman. "Well, how's your squaw?" Taken aback, all he could do was blurt out, "Fine, and how's yours?" One of the implications with racial prejudice in the church is that some members believe the white race is the chosen race, the one blessed above all others, and if you're white, male, and Mormon, you're the most blessed. To help dispel this belief, Elder John K. Carmack wrote, "We do not believe that any nation, race, or culture is a lesser breed or inferior in God's eyes. Those who believe or teach such doctrine have no authority from either the Lord or his authorized servants." Elder Bruce R. McConkie, in an address given after the 1978 revelation to give the black race the priesthood, quoted the passage, 2 Nephi, chapter 26, 33, about all being alike unto God, and then said, "Many of us never imagined or supposed that these passages had the extensive and broad meaning that they do have." President Howard W. Hunter said, "The gospel of Jesus Christ transcends nationality and color, crosses cultural lines, and blends distinctiveness into a common brotherhood. All men are invited to come unto him, and all are alike unto him. Race makes no difference, colors makes no difference, nationality makes no difference. As members of the Lord's church, we need to lift our vision beyond personal prejudices. We need to discover the supreme truth that indeed our Father is no respecter of persons. Except for direct racial slurs, I am well aware that I don't always know if prejudice and discrimination is attributed to race or gender or both or some other factor. Understandably, people in and out of the church do not often among non-whites tell racist jokes or say they dislike dark skin or slanty eyes. What I observe is how an individual or group treats me compared to how they treat others. For example, in staff meetings, I have made suggestions which people do not notice. A few minutes later, a male colleague may make the same suggestions, and people, women in particular, ooh and on, say, "Oh, that's a great idea." Was this racial or gender-induced? By the way, it never ceases to amaze me that women show prejudice toward other women, having experienced prejudice and discrimination ourselves. Just like in Taiwan, where I taught English for nearly 2 years, the Chinese treat foreigners better than they treat their own people. At a dinner party not long ago, in response to questions I had asked of him, this gentleman, white, only made eye contact with my husband as he was answering my questions. In another conversation at the same dinner, this time with an African-American woman, she also only looked at my husband while again answering my questions. Was this behavior racial or gender related? In a small Utah company where the majority of the workers are members, I was told by a male employee there that what men say about women who disagree with them, she's such a bitch. If they really don't like her, they say, she's a sucking bitch. When this was said of a specific employee one day, she overheard the offensive remark and is thinking of pressing sexual harassment charges, not only for that remark, but also for non-promotion of female workers to managerial positions. I was told women are definitely second-class citizens at this Mormon male company. Even though I was born in the U.S., I do not feel connected or rooted to this country, though I love America and intend to live here until I die. The reason for that angst, I suppose, comes from having been excluded and disparaged. At the same time, I also do not fit in or feel connected to my ethnic country, so that in China, I feel like a stranger, and here I feel estranged. In other words, I don't feel like I belong in either country. This you all know, that racial prejudice and discrimination is demeaning and humiliating, and is a form of rejection that causes insecurity and esteem issues. Nevertheless, some people are proud of their prejudice and flaunt it like a new Mercedes. For example, a prominent teacher and writer gave an impressive speech where he said he learned he was this and he learned he was that, and he learned growing up that his whiteness was superior to other races, having been raised in an all-white Mormon community. Stating such, you'd assume he would want to change that belief. However, he had little or no desire to eradicate that belief. Instead, he seemed to purposely parade that piece of so-called revelation to show audiences what a sensitive, progressive, and Renaissance male he was. The combination of my home life, coupled with how Utah classmates and ward members have ostracized me, has taken some 20-odd years since graduating from college to really like myself and to form an identity of my own, though I still struggle with melancholy and despondency. These experiences have shaped who I am today in terms of feeling more connected and rooted to an inanimateness than to people, being more attracted to nature, music, literature, and art. However, the paradox is I also long for closeness and intimacy with others and avoid situations and organizations where the impersonal may be the norm. If that means living a reclusive life, then I choose to live reclusively. Rabbi Harold Kushner in a TV interview said it succinctly, "Even though people love my sermons, the thing they like most about me is if I know their names." One of the panel questions is, how do we know we are participating in this problem? Let's say a non-white member is giving a lesson or giving an opinion in a Sunday school class. Are we thinking about his race, or are we thinking about his words? My closest friends who happen to be white tell me they forget that I'm Asian. That is, until I talk about prejudice and racism. At church meetings and activities, are we visiting with the same group every time, or are we including others? Do we make eye contact? Do we give the same critical thinking analysis and recognition to a non-white's opinion or talk as we do a white person's? Do we teach our children to accept and to embrace differences in people, not only of color, but also of religion, nationality, sexual orientation, disability, and so on? I'm very concerned that one of my sons too quickly judges a person's character if he smokes or drinks, or she has tattoos or body piercings, that he sometimes won't look beyond these superficial marks. Outside of church and work, do we socialize with non-white members? Do we go to a concert or movie together, and do we invite them over to our house for a barbecue? Do we encourage our children to mingle and make friends of different backgrounds? In closing, I don't have great and glorious revelatory gems of wisdom to help delete racial prejudice, only that we, which includes me, need to treat people with equity and justice. If there be wisdom, it would be Christ's admonition to do unto others as we would like done to us. We don't have to like everyone, and we won't like everyone, but we can believe with conviction in equity and justice, and thereby treat people accordingly. If we are rude to one person, let us be rude to everyone. You see, I don't mind if a sales clerk says nothing to me, but if he says to the person in front of me, "Hi, how are you? Did you get everything you needed?" And then he says the same thing to the person behind me, but he says nothing to me, then I wonder why. The beloved Lowell Bunyan said, "I have long pondered the significance of love, which Paul declares to be not only greater than faith, but more certain than knowledge. As I have grown older, I have come to understand more clearly the limits of knowledge. Truly, we know only in part and see through the glass darkly. Our experience with knowledge is always limited, tentative, and incomplete, while the experience of Christ's love is drenching, profound, and transforming. Nothing matters ultimately in any setting, in marriage, the family, school, the church, the community, the world, except what happens to persons. The sacred moments when I have tasted of Christ's love have fully satisfied me and simultaneously given me an abiding hunger for more. And I have found that the best way to satisfy that hunger is to express something of the same love to others. Thank you very much for your presence and your interest.
Well, I want to thank you for this opportunity. It's great to be here. To start with my presentation, I'm going to ask my colleagues here, my panelists, to raise a little bit of the material that they brought for this presentation. I see that Lana has some flyers. If you can raise it for just a little bit. Okay, and we already saw what she used, and I see here Natalie with... And I don't either. And now I'm going to ask them if they can stand in front of this table right here with me. They can come. Just that. Yes. Oh. Okay. Now that you... I want you to look at them and look at me. And I'm definitely... a little bit more casual here on my dress, and I did it for a purpose. So thank you so much. Usually, we tend to look at people just by the way they look, and we create judgment of the people. You know, that's exactly why I dress this way. I wanted to come very casual, and... see the reaction of people when they say, so, she's the panelist? Oh, my gosh. You know? And that's part of what we get when we find people of other races. You know, a lot of times we don't do it voluntarily. It's not just because we're white or we're black or we're brown or we're blue. It's just because we don't know about other people. And there is always the fear of the unknown. I have dealt with that a lot, and it's not that people don't like me, because once they get to know me, they like me. Most of them, at least, I like to think so. But it's the fear of the not known. When I came here to Utah, and that's something that I think a lot of the people who had not lived here or that has moved to Utah has found out, being members of the church, is that the LDS church here in Utah is different from everywhere else. I have lived in Ecuador. I have lived in my country where I'm from, Colombia. I have traveled many places. And the one thing I have found is that the church here in Utah is different from everywhere else. You know, if you're not, a lot of times if you're not white, and definitely, if you're not a member of the LDS church, you can count yourself excluded. You're not part of the group. You're not in. And that's sad. And it's unfortunate. We went to a ward where the bishop never called my mother by her name. She called her mom. She was sick. For a week, sick as a dog. And the bishop never showed up at her door and say, how can I help? We definitely all are equals unto God. But are we equals in front of our members, our friends, our neighbors? Are we equal? Do we feel equal? That's definitely a question. And when we find someone who may be not Hispanic... you know, how do I react? Because we have to look at both ways. We cannot always just look, oh, whites look at us differently. Do we look at other people in the same way? And what can we do to change that? And definitely we always hear that kids are the future. And that, I think, that's the place where we need to start. I have a 9-year-old boy and a 6-year-old girl. And one of the things that I try to teach them because of my experiences is you have to get to know people before you make a judgment. You have to know whether they're good or bad. And that's something that I really think is one of the biggest teachings and heritage that we can leave to our kids, is teach them to love the people. We are equals unto God. So let's do it. Let's do what the gospel teaches. This book is perfect. It has the knowledge of the church. It has the perfect gospel. But we don't use it as it should be. That's our problem. The gospel is perfect, but are we perfect? We came here to learn, and I think that's part of the learning process. Is one of the things that my mom taught me and keep teaching me is, you know, we came here to teach how and to learn. How to love people. That's all we need to learn. If we learn that, we will be okay. And I truly believe that. I have friends from living in many places. My mother was a consul of Colombia in Ecuador, was a diplomatic. So you get to travel a lot and meet a lot of people. And that's wonderful. My profession, I'm a journalist. You get to meet people everywhere, different backgrounds. And there is nothing more beautiful than learn and take the best from other people. And that's basically, I love questions and answers, so I try to keep mine short. And, you know, I'm there once we finish. I would love to answer questions to whoever have them. But definitely one of the things that we must remember is that the gospel is perfect. And if we leave it, that's what makes us different. There, it doesn't exist white, blue, green, yellow. What she said, I love what you said. You know, it would be so boring if we all were blonde, blue eyes, you know. Definitely. I love the fact my daughter is, I'm the darkest in my family. So they call me Negrita. You know, like Blackie. You know, and all my family called me that way. But it would be so boring. What would they call me if I was, you know, lighter like they are? You know, so definitely we need to find a way, and especially teach our children. If we start there, we will be fine. Teach our children to get together with other kids. You know, I have seen it when they are like, no, the neighbor next door is not a member of the church, so don't get together with that kid. That's trouble. Is it really trouble? Do we know them to pass that judgment that that kid is trouble? Or is it just because he doesn't share the same beliefs that we have? Thank you.
My name is Leilani Ann Katoa Taholo. My father is Latu Inoke Katoa from Tongatapu, Tonga. His father was Semisi Katoa from the Tongan Islands as well. And his mother is Anaseni Takipo Katoa Tamoipeau, and she is also from Tongatapu. My mother is Lorna Leigh Martinson. Her father is Samuela Pele Martinson from the Big Island of Hawaii, and her mother is Su Laiwan Ako, who is from mainland China. If you were to know my grandfather's father, his name was Samuel Martinson. He was full-blooded Norwegian, decided to migrate to the big island of Hawaii and settled in Wahinu, Hawaii, which is the county of Kau, which is the southern part of the big island. And they had created a plantation out there to raise their family. And so when you, if you were to see my grandfather, he is a very tall, half Norwegian, half Hawaiian looking man. He's very handsome. My grandmother, I think the most she has ever weighed is 115 pounds in her whole life. She's very small frame, small bone. I love that part of her culture where I've got to know some of my ancestry from mainland China. I'm very proud of that. On my Tongan side, I understand that we also have some German blood. Some of you may know the Wolfgram families, and they are Tongan, but their last name is Wolfgram, and that comes from the German descent. After the World War, there were some Germans that had settled into the Tongan Islands and had intermarried. I love that diversity, that part that runs through my veins. That blood flows through my veins, and I'm very proud of that. Makes up a rich part of who I am, who I believe I am. I feel very connected to all of these beautiful women that are here. I wanted Margaret to know that one of my dreams is to go out to Sicily and to spend some time in Italy and Spain, and that's actually one of my goals. I was actually asked to go out to when the Olympics were in Spain. I had served my mission in Peru Lima Norte in Peru, and had spent some time in Ecuador, and so I had learned the language quite fluently, and the Polynesian dancing troupe was heading out to Spain to go and perform, and they were asking me if I would go help them translate, and some people thought that was really pretty funny because I was a Spanish-speaking Polynesian, so going out there. But just, again, the diversity, that just strikes me as being really cool and fun. I also have attended Genesis that Natalie is a part of, and one of my best friends was a black fellow that I went to high school with at Kearns High, and we got real close, and he invited me to Genesis, and some of the most spiritual experiences I've had in a church setting in meetings has been at Genesis, and I feel real connected there. Obviously, I feel connected with you, for me, through my grandmother. When you were here and you were standing here, I just, again, I'm leaving next month to go spend time with her in Oahu, and she wants to show me more and more information and pictures about our ancestry and that part that comes from mainland China. It was just beautiful. Are you from Taiwan? Is that where?
No. Excuse me, I was born in the U.S.
You were born in the U.S.
But my parents are from the mainland.
But your parents are from the mainland. I didn't want to assume that. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And like I said before, I served my mission in Peru, and I spent time in Ecuador, and in Guayaquil and in Quito. And so I feel very connected with all of these women up here. And I, again, love the diversity. When Richard G. Scott stated that whatever culture we came from, the important one was to belong to the culture of Christ, I really took that and I weighed it out, and I went through scriptures, prayed about it, and this is what I decided, that belonging to the culture of Christ is belonging to all the good parts of all the cultures and being connected to those. For me, when we allow ourselves not to get to know others that are different from us, or who have other diversities, or who don't exactly believe the way that we believe, I feel that we actually make at some level a decision not to be connected somehow to that part that exists in the world, in the very same world in which we live. And when we make that kind of a conscious choice not to be connected to that, then somehow there is a loss. I believe that there's a loss. So what I decided to do even more so after that was, I want to be conscious about the connections that I want to make. And what was neat for me was, as I saw all these beautiful women up here, I thought, you know what? I feel connected to every single one of these women, and I want to get more connected. There is an assumption that if you're Anglo and you're from Utah, that you don't have culture as well. But you do. That is a culture, okay? Especially where we tend, at many times when I am in some of my groups where there are more ethnic minority folks, they'll say, well, you know, male, Utah, you know, LDS. I say, that is a culture. That's a culture too. And if I really open myself to open up to that and expand my mind to that, what that can do is help dispel some of the myths. Now, that's really important to me to work on dispelling myths, because there are a lot of myths that float around about Polynesians. And I would like to help kind of dispel some of those, some of the myths, in terms of throwing that over as a blanket over all Polynesians and thinking or believing that this is the way we do things. Now, there's the film called Other Side of Heaven. And, of course, that's John Groberg's Hollywoodized, in a sense, version of where when he served his mission in Tonga. And I've seen it twice. And the first time, I actually had kind of a tongue-in-cheek kind of yucky aftertaste after I when I left the movie the first time. And part of it was, while I was sitting in the room, there were quite a few comments about what was going on during his missionary experiences in Tonga, and they sounded, which was fine with me, but when it started to curve into, is that how they all do things, or is that how they all eat, or it's okay that they all burp at the table because he just said that it's okay to burp, I mean, that's actually good manners, and I thought, oh, my grandmother would have spanked me if I had burped at the table, so that's not true for this Polynesian, and so it was really kind of a little bit of a bittersweet experience for me watching the movie. The second time was there was a very small crowd, and I went with my sister, and I went with my we went with my brother-in-law, and my brother-in-law is a tall, half black, half white, very handsome gentleman who is really, he's a non-member as far as LDS church, and was very, very curious as to what is the experience of LDS missionaries in a foreign country. So he really wanted to see this. And you know, this time I hardly heard any comments, and I could just sit back and relax and watch the movie. And that time I really thought, okay, this was kind of a different experience for me, and I could really enjoy some of the beauty that I saw, like the faith of my people and what they had experienced. And if you've seen the movie, one of the most touching pieces for me where a connection is made is when there is one young man by the name of Finau that actually dies in the movie. And when Elder Groberg finds out that he dies, he actually leans over him and he bawls, as a Polynesian would bawl, out loud, and you just weep and wail and you release it. And he was crying out, "Oh Yahweh," which means, "Ow, this really hurts." And I felt a connection there. And I missed that connection the first time I saw the movie, because I wasn't paying attention to the movie. I was paying attention to what was going on around me. And this time I could really feel more connected with that. What I wanted to bring to you was show you what we call katoteo. Many times, some of the myths that we have about some of our Polynesian folks that are here, or whether they're in Utah or somewhere in the United States, is that they're large and mean. Okay. Maybe some of us are, but not all. That the women are subservient. Maybe some of us are, but we are not all. I don't see myself as very subservient. if a police station is called, and there's domestic violence involved, and it involves a Polynesian population, that you better bring a backup unit because they're very, very mean and can do a lot of damage to just one person or two persons if they come out representing the law enforcement. And, you know, in some cases that may be true, but not for all. Okay? What I want us to get smart about is to really check out the screens through which we see things. I question, for example, videos. I was showing a video to my Polynesian group, the Mana group, which means inner power, that we run on Wednesday nights at the Redwood Multipurpose Building. It's for Polynesian youth that are in youth corrections or on probation. And we talk about thinking errors. Thinking errors. And one of the things that I was showing to them was some of the culture in the Fiji and Solomon Islands. Well, guess who was narrating it? It was an Australian who maybe it had some connection with the people, but when he was narrating, it was actually as if he were exploring things with while they were filming it. It wasn't someone that had already, from what I understood, that was actually a part of the people. So I was thinking, what am I actually experiencing in this video? I'm actually seeing someone else's view on how these people live. Now, it would have been much more informative to me to actually have a Solomon Islander or a Fijian actually be the narrator. And then they are presenting their experience among their own people that they live among. So really checking out our own screens and who are we getting this information through, I think is part of really good critical thinking. This is a grief and loss basket. In Tongan, it's called a katoteo. And part of the grieving and the loss, when we experience that, when my father passed away, my grandmother said, "Do you know what katoteo means?" And I said, "Well, teo means work. Kato means purse or basket." And she said, "Yep." And she said, "I want you to have this basket." And I said, "Okay, Grandma, what do I do with it?" And she said, "You work on it." I said, "Okay." She said, "I want you to go into the closet and I want you to pick out whatever you remember about Dad. Things that you really remember." I had to have his Pan American hat. He worked for Pan Am for many, many years. I had to have his harmonica that I remember him playing when he was a young man. I had to have his Aloha shirt and the last hat he wore in my house before he died. Those were all connecting things for me. This, to me, brothers and sisters, if you'll let me call you that, thank you, is one more piece of information to show you that we all die. We are all born. We all pretty much come into this world and exit out of it pretty much the same way. And in my particular culture, this is how I can actually learn how to work through the grief of losing my father. I can take his clothes and I can smell it and I can have it with me. I keep this in my house. If there's a fire, this is the very first thing I'm grabbing. This and my pictures. I keep it real right by the door, so if I need to exit, I'm out of there because this is so precious to me. That's the message. I've got like 2 minutes, so let me just share just a couple more things. I really want to be a voice that says, please check out your assumptions. I'm working really hard on checking out mine. I think that that is so important. Let's just kick those assumptions and figure out what it is that we make assumptions about each and every day, and especially when it comes to ethnic minority racism, when it comes to that. What kinds of assumptions do we carry within us? Question those. I was really excited when we were going to have the Olympics in Utah, just for the pure reason that I wanted to see much more of the world come here and have Utah experience the world. I didn't see it as the world experiencing Utah, although obviously that was going to happen. To me, it was an opportunity for Utah to experience the rest of the world, which I was very excited about. Thank you for letting me be here today. There's a lot more that I could say, and I won't. I want to respect the time that's here. Please take to heart what you've heard today. I hope you'll really, really heavily consider what you've heard today, and that you'll begin to connect with some of that, and that it'll make a difference in your life. One last piece. This is called a lokahi wheel. It means balance and harmony. And if you look at all the different parts, physical body, spiritual soul, friends and family, work and job, thinking and life, emotions, feelings and emotions, that is the word for balance and harmony in Hawaiian. And what that also entails is that we all experience that. No matter what we look like on the outside, we all experience this. Thank you very much.
Thank you for letting me be here today. First of all, I have to dispel the myth. I was not married in 1991. I was married earlier, and the only reason I need to tell you that is because I have children that were born when we were married, and they just need to not hear this tape and think that any different. So I just wanted to dispel that, but that's okay. My name is Natalie Frances Teresa Elizabeth Ann Palmer Shepherd. I was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio, in an all-black Catholic community, and I was the first granddaughter and the first niece, and so I had to have everybody's name. So that's how that came about. I won't write down anything. I just wanted to talk a little bit about racism in Utah and my experiences, I suppose. I've been in here for 20 years, so had you asked me 20 years ago, I was an angry black woman and I could have given you an earful. I'm a lot more mellower now. However, what shocks me is that my 9-year-old son came home from school yesterday and said, "Mom, this little boy called me a nigger." Excuse me for saying that word. And what is so sad to me is we're looking at August of 2002, and racism still exists. And the saddest thing of all is that oftentimes people think you change locations and you change a feeling. When you change locations, that's all you've done. You don't change people, you simply change your locations. I came to Utah, like I said, in 1982, and experienced the rudest awakening of my life. I did. I joined the LDS Church in Cincinnati, Ohio. I came to the land of Zion. I was more than a little bit excited to be here. I had never in my life, and I grew up in the racial strife of the 60s, and I had never experienced as much racism as I experienced when I came to Utah. I mean, you're looking at a woman who used to lay on the floor in Cincinnati, Ohio, while the Ku Klux Klan shot through our windows, but I still had never experienced the type of racism I experienced when I came to Utah. And the interesting thing is that, unlike a lot of people, anybody that knows me, the last thing you would describe me to be is shy or timid or any of those things. I mean, I'm a lot of things, but those have never been adjectives that have been used to describe me. And when I first came here, my son, I can remember, I have like 1,001 stories I could relate, but one of the stories I remember vividly is that my oldest son was 6 years old when I came to Utah, and he had gone to school, and I attended the University of Utah. He was going to elementary school, and I came home one day, and he was sitting outside. Back up just a second. When I came to Utah originally, I was invited here by the missionary that baptized my sister's family. So we came here with a place to stay, according to them, because I was going to come and leave my kids home and just come here, get established, and then send for them. But instead, I came with them. And so I came home from the university one day, and he was sitting outside of the people we were staying with's home, and it was snowing. And I said, "Why are you sitting out here?" And he said, "They won't let me in their house." So I knocked on the door because they wouldn't give us a key, and I said, "Why is he sitting outside?" "Well, we can't have him in here when you're not here. We don't know what your kind do." We had stayed with these people for like 2.5 weeks. I had been here. I said, "Okay, my kind is about to go live in my car with my kids. I'm not about to stay here any longer," which is what I did. So I lived in my car for about 3 months, and we snuck into hotels and took showers while the people were cleaning. And suddenly I got really, really angry. I was really mad. So I went down to church office building and I demanded to see the prophet. And for some absurd reason, they thought I was crazy. And so I said, excuse me, but if Joseph Smith could see Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ, and you're trying to tell me I can't see the prophet? Make me understand this. So they put me in this little room, and they surrounded the whole room with these security, these men in little black suits and ties. And I ranted and raved about the treatment that I experienced in Utah, and I went on and on and on about how I had come to this land of Zion, and this is how I was treated, and I had never been treated this way in Cincinnati, Ohio. Because, don't get me wrong, racism existed in Cincinnati, Ohio, but you knew in advance it was racist. Nobody was walking around pretending. Nobody was grinning in your face and subtly, very, you know, offended at the whole idea that you existed in the world. But this was 1982, okay? And I could go on with that story, but it's too long to go on to, but I did have some really good experiences. Ha, 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 don't you feel bad that I won't tell you in? I'm not going to tell you. But anyway, because I got to move forward a little bit, because I don't want Margaret to put a five-minute thing up here on my stand. But I have to move forward a little bit, because that was 1982. This is the year 2002. All is well in the world. You don't expect, as a black woman, to experience racism today. Okay, my little boy comes home from school. He says, this little boy called him a nigger. And I said, so what did the teacher do? And the teacher told him to apologize. The sad thing about that to me is I can remember several years ago having to go into a ward and explain to 16 and 17-year-olds where the word nigger originated and why it's offensive to say it in the first place. That's what I think. I keep wanting to say brothers and sisters like I'm in a fast and testimony meeting. But that's what I think is interesting, is that people oftentimes want to throw words out there, and the lack of knowledge, ignorance, is that you don't even know where it came from. And I said I was going to move forward to the year 2002. I presently work as in the Jordan River Temple. And I was in the temple about 2 months ago, minding my own business, smiling, greeting people, saying, welcome, you know, doing it the best I know how. And this brother walks up to me and he says, I can't believe they allowed you in here. I cannot believe you are in this temple. Why would they let a black person work in this temple? This wasn't 1982, so therefore I didn't get upset. Instead, two other women that were in earshot because it wasn't quiet, they came up. Four men came up who also worked in the temple, and before I knew it, this guy was gone. And it's so interesting to me that that happened like that, because then everybody was apologizing for the whole rest of the shift that I was there. But what was sad to me, I was more sad for him than for me. Because for me, I've been in Utah so long that the people that I know in Utah are closer to me than the people I know in my family in Ohio. And most of those people are white. So for me, I meet people. I belong to the Genesis group, which is a support group for black Latter-day Saints and their families and friends. I, like Margaret said, I served as a Genesis Relief Society president for many years, and I met a lot of people, black, white, brown, purple, green. My children's favorite song is Jesus Loves the Little Children, red and yellow, black and white. They are precious in his sight. And for me, interacting with different types of people, my level, I still have times when I just am irritated by people. But I'm more irritated by people, not because of the color of their skin, but because of the content of their character. No, I'm just joking. But not because of the color of their skin, but because of how ignorant they are toward each other. And that's what is sad to me, is that I am trying to teach my children to love themselves in spite of people. I am a daughter of a loving Father in heaven, and I am busy building his kingdom. So in so doing, I really can't deal with the pettiness. But the sad thing is that in spite of how I feel as a 45-year-old woman, I have children. I mean, I'm bothered to mention my youngest child is 3 and my oldest is 26. Nobody told me where children come from, so I just kind of forgot. But I have children that on a daily basis, I have to deal with their issues. Our older children left Utah and said they would never come back to Utah because of the racism they experienced here. So when we're sitting, or me as a black woman, sitting trying to teach my children that all are alike unto God, how ironic for them when on a daily basis somebody doesn't hesitate to remind them differently. And for me, I guess my message to each and every one of you would be, open your minds. It is up to each and every one of us to change the mindset that presently exists in this wonderful state of Utah. If we don't change that mindset, because if you think about it, it is so easy for someone to offend you and you to be defensive right back and ready to offend in return. But if instead we gather ourselves and we remember what Paul said, follow me as I follow Christ, that's the kind of life I want to live. And if that's the kind of life I want to live, that's the kind of life I want to teach my children. That's the kind of life I want to teach your children. And in so doing, that it begins as we progress, we begin to change that mindset and we do become that Zion-like people or that type of a people, like Margaret was saying, where we look beyond the color of someone's skin, or for that matter, whether they're a woman or a man. We look beyond all those issues and we look at the person and we either like them or dislike them. And yes, it's okay to dislike somebody, but we either like them or dislike them based on their character and the way that they treat us, and not so much because, oh, that's a person, that's a dark person, that's a chocolate person, which is somebody called me in Provo. And we're chocolate and vanilla, and we're not black and white. And it's okay, you know, but I look at my children, and I ache for my children. I ache for the children of my friend whose husband is black and her children are black. I ache for those children because we're trying to teach them to feel good about themselves, and we're trying to give them words that say, you're a child of a loving Father in heaven, and you're a child of God, and all of these things. And yet, it starts right here. It starts in this room where we change our mindset and we get to know, like Lonnie said, we get to know about other cultures. We get to learn what people are about. And therefore, when somebody says it to you, you can correct that person. How much time do I have? Because I want to say something really quick.
We have like 5 or 6 minutes.
Oh, I talked that fast? Oh, okay. I wanted to share something with you, and again, you know, I don't write things down so they kind of pop, but actually I go in the restroom, I say a prayer, and I know that I will say what you need to hear. I used to be the gospel doctrine teacher in my ward a few years ago. At the same time, I was Genesis Relief Society president, but it came time for me, and we were studying Doctrine and Covenants this particular year, and I don't know if any of you are non-LDS here, you wouldn't know what that meant, but it's a part of the Book of Mormon, and if you don't know what that meant, it's another testament of Jesus Christ. But all that aside, it is a book that the LDS Church has that helps you to teach the gospel, as taught by the LDS Church. It's time for me to teach this lesson, and it was on Revelation number 2. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but that was supposedly that great, wonderful day when the blacks were given the priesthood in June of 1978. I stood up there to teach this lesson. And aside from this, or along with this, is the fact that how sad it is that there are so many people with such a lack of knowledge that very few people realize that when the church was restored on the earth, black men had the priesthood. There were black men who died in full fellowship of the gospel, who came to Utah with the Mormon pioneers, held the priesthood, went on missions, and died in full fellowship. That aside, it's time for me to teach this lesson. I open up this manual. I'm at home. I open up this manual, and it says, there's one group of people who has never held the priesthood in this dispensation. So again, you have to know Natalie Palmer Shepherd. I called the church administration building. I asked to speak to Elder David B. Haight because he was the mission leader over the Wasatch Front, and he would have the answer. Not to mention, I had been meeting with this man since 1988, every Thursday, anyway. So I picked up, but that's a whole nother, like I told you, so you got to read my book. I called him up and I said, Elder Haight, you know, I need to meet with you. I have issues with this. I have to teach this lesson on Sunday, and I will not stand up in a meeting and say this because it's a lie. So he said, fax me the thing. So I made a copy of it. I faxed it to him. Then I had a meeting with him the next morning, and I go in, and he said, well, you know this is a lie. It's not that big of a deal. I'm sorry. I love Elder David B. Haight. He's my best friend. I love him, next to my husband. And so he said, just teach it from your heart. Teach this lesson. So instead, I called Darius Gray, who is the president of the Genesis Group. And I said, okay, Darius, you have so much more tact than me. You are so much more humbled than I will ever be, because on a daily basis I'm seeking to get where you are. And he just laughs at me. I said, but I really need you to come and teach this lesson. The interesting thing about it, he comes to my ward this Sunday. He addresses the people. It's a full, more people than it's here. He says, how many of you people know, this is how you did it, why blacks were denied the priesthood after Nauvoo? You know, it's important how you word it, okay? Were denied the priesthood after Nauvoo and their trek to Utah. Everybody in that room raised their hand, including me. Everybody had an answer. And he said, that is so interesting, because I just met with President Hinckley. I asked him the very same question, and he said he did not know. And so you're telling me that you know more than the prophet himself. And that is extremely interesting. I wanted to share that with you because, again, we live with many myths. But these myths are perpetrated by the literature we read. You can still buy books in the BYU library that will help you with these myths. What we're attempting to do is dispel those myths. And you need to understand that the curse of Cain, if you think about that no one will be punished for Adam's sins but for their own transgressions, and then you think about the curse of Cain, then you figure it out. But I want, I'll leave you with just knowing, I wish I would have wrote something down so I could leave you with something profound. Let's see. I can't think of anything, so let me just say something. I just want to leave you with this. Love isn't love, a wise sage once said, unless you give it away. And neither is Christ's love effective in any of our lives unless we're willing to share it with each other. Thank you.
You were all so good about sticking to your times. We have 15 minutes left for questions and interaction with the audience, and I'm hoping for a lively discussion. If you panelists want to talk to each other, the audience, let's just get going on a discussion. So, let's see. You can stay where you are, use the microphone. We need to talk in the microphone so that it's on the tape. Okay? And I will get this and maybe go with the audience. There we go. Okay.
Here we go. And I'm going to come out.
Here. So. Yeah, I'm good at being challenged.
Congratulations. What a wonderful panel. I'm Dr. Lou Wallace. Just a few comments. There's only one race. It's called the human race. Sister Shepherd, you've got about half a gram of more melanin than I have, but you could pile it on a nickel if you were careful. So that's the difference in the races. This color is white. If I were white, I'd be an albino, a freak. So every time Margaret used the word white, I thought freak, freak, freak.
I've had
a wonderful experience as a doctor in school in Los Angeles. My instructors, my nurses, my patients were all races, many black. And I'd been fortunate enough to have in my home in Idaho Falls, my father's fishing companion was the only black in southern Idaho Falls. And we were in each other's homes and they went fishing and slept together camping. And so I was relieved of some of the inherent prejudice that you absorb from your civilization. And I'm a little disappointed only in that when I come to some... See, I've been fighting this thing on the priesthood since the 1950s. I was sabotaging the whole thing by copying out of the Doctrine and Covenants the 21 places where it said that the gospel was for all people, all men, every creature, all mankind. I'd like to remind the Mormons again that there's one revelation that says it's for everybody, and it's dated September 1842, and it says this revelation is in force from this hour on. We're a little slow in obeying the Lord's commands. Enough said.
You may have to stand up, but...
I have a question for the panel. I'm a bishop of a single adult ward in Mesa, a very large ward. We have about 350 young adults. And, of course, the younger generation is more tolerant and accepting of diversity. We have all races. We have African American, we have Polynesian, Arabic, we have Oriental, Hispanic in our ward. But something that I've noticed that I don't know if you can comment on, the young men minorities who attend the ward seem to more easily integrate into positions of leadership, and they seem to be more accepted, more popular. And the young women seem to kind of hold back and stand back and don't seem to be as comfortably integrated into the ward. And I wondered if that's something you've noticed, if you have any comments to make.
I'd like to hear from all of you. Just who wants to talk first?
Well, I'll tell you my experience, at least. When I was living in Colombia, and just so you know, my dad is black. And he got baptized when they couldn't have the priesthood. So I know what you say, and that all the things that go through, they have to go through. But anyway, when I was living in Colombia, I was, otherwise you can call a leader, since I was probably 16. I've moved to Utah, and I just got my first calling now. So 11 years later. You know, and I have been in different words, you know, and a lot of times it's just because they are not used to getting the opportunity to be called to serve, because it's reserved for white, you know, or but that has been my experience, and that was very hard for me when I moved here, was the fact that my son is usually there, start at 7:30, you know, and end up at 8, you know, and then I came here, and it was like, okay, now what do I do? You know, you go to church, and everybody leaves, and you're like, they don't even talk to each other, after, you know, after church. They just go to church and see you next week, you know. So we need to integrate. We need to I don't know the exactly answer, but I do know that if they get the opportunity and they feel love, they will do it.
Bishop, what I'm hoping for is that you would actually consider going to each and every one of those young women and actually asking them why they haven't had that experience yet. One of the things I don't want to do is actually feed into the racism by actually assuming that they're all having the same experience. So what I think what part of kicking my own assumptions is actually going to the person and actually asking them. I'm hoping that you'll consider that. The other piece is that if there is something within the culture that lends itself to that piece where they don't, you know, feel like they can actually go in and say, do you have an opening for a calling or something? They're individually... I can only speak from my own experience. Depending upon their own families and what the male-female role kind of looks like, that may also have a play into it. But my biggest piece would be to, I hope that you'll consider to go ask each and every one of them. Because after you do ask each and every one of them, it would be really interesting to kind of take a poll and see if they are having the same experience or if it's actually different for each and every one of them.
I talk too much, but anyway, I like to talk. In answer to your question, because I kind of heard you say, have any of us ever experienced that as well? Did you say that, or did I imagine that you said it? Or should you have said it anyway? No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
I wondered if women of minority feel less inclined to project themselves into the Mormon community as distinguished from the men.
See, and my experience has been different from that. I don't see the women feeling that way, but being treated that way instead. That's what I see. I do not see, because do I look shy? But my experience has been is that I was in a ward for a long time, probably like 3 years, and I went to the bishop and said, are you going to give me a calling, or should I go to the church office building, or what? Because I really, really need to understand what's going on here. So, but oftentimes, you know, people are feeling, I agree with Lonnie, you probably do need to make that move, because those people are probably feeling all kind of things that aren't even real. They might even be feeling like you're not giving them a calling because of their nationality. So you might want to check it out.
I'm one of those kind of Northern European Scandinavian that Margaret was talking about. I mean, there's, yeah, purely like Scandinavian Northern European. And I have always craved ethnicity. And it's interesting to hear me to say you say that, Lonnie, that we do have an ethnicity, but I've never felt like I really did. And I always wanted to be, you know, Mexican. Honestly, I thought they had great food and a really great history, and it was really interesting to me. But I felt like that was lacking in my life. And I've been thinking a lot about issues of color, actually, in the last 6 months. I started a book group last fall, and we decided for Black History Month we wanted to read a book that dealt with the Black experience, and we read the Having Our Say, the book by the Delaney sisters, read both the book and the play that was adapted from it. And then I read on my own a book called Slaves in the Family by Edward Ball. And I don't know if you've heard of this book. It's by a man, a white man descended from slaveholders in the South in the Charleston area, rice growers. And he decided that his family had held all these slaves, and he knew nothing about the history of these people who were owned by his family, and in some cases were his family because of plantation owners who slept with their slaves, and that these were relatives, and he wanted to know about them as much as he knew about his white relatives, and did all this research. And when I started thinking about color, reading Having Our Say book, is because these women had their mother who had a white father, and you know, like she was. The blackness in her was so diluted that to our modern eyes, because our definitions are based more on appearance than on our history, that to my modern eyes, she looked white. I mean, she was white. But in the 19th century, the definitions were very different about, and in reading Edward Ball's book, and he found in his research times where people had moved, and in their moving had assumed a different racial identity and had started passing for white. And so I was thinking about it, it just really struck me really hard at this time how arbitrary and how artificial these distinctions have that we are that are based on race. And I'm glad to see you nodding. Also because within my own family, you know, I have, my parents are same white, Scandinavian, everything. I have a sister with very dark olive skin and curly hair who could pass for, you know, some kind of other woman of color. She's my sister of color, even though she's the same color, she's about the same. So, anyway.
I just wanted to make a comment that, you know, if you have any relatives from Norway, we could be related. You know, it's my mother's maiden name is Martinsen. And it's S-O-N. And if it's Martinsen, S-E-N, they're Swedish.
No, S-O-N.
Oh, S-O-N is the other way. Okay.
Or Danish is
S-O-N. Or Danish, yeah. So S-O-N is really, so what am I?
No. S-O-N is Swedish.
Swedish. If any of you are Swedes, we could be related. So, yes. So, again, the fact that if we were to just go purely by what we see up here on the surface, we would never
know the connections. Yeah, it's interesting. My daughters think that my husband's Italian side is much more interesting than my boring Mormon English Scandinavian side. They want the ethnicity too, and only one of them got the olive skin. Lucky girl.
Well, thank you for your comments. They were wonderful. My stream of thought through this whole panel session is just everywhere. Sandra, you made a comment about living in different parts of the world and traveling a lot, and how the church is different than it is here in Utah. And having grown up in Cincinnati, Ohio, I understand that concept. My family came from Salt Lake, and the thought that I had is that there seems to be an elitism with Mormons in Utah and maybe Southern Idaho, because my family is one of those that moved to Cincinnati and brought with them our culture, the Mormon culture, to another part of the world. And what I've discovered in my own process as an LDS person is how sanitized the gospel is because of this elitism that takes place. And as a woman, I find myself slipping away from that and falling to the margins. So as I'm listening to you, I just wonder, why is it that, well, first of all, how come you women are not a part of the General Relief Society board? Because why are you not like the, you know, for women, you know, the main, the highlights, you know, the presidency? Because listening to you, you bring, I just feel nourishment by what you guys say. And I'm very impressed because I feel like I need to have more of this diversity, which we don't have.
Well, like I said, you should read my book.
What's the name of it, Natalie? And when is it coming out?
Well, the name of it's going to be I Demand to See the Prophet. But I only have four chapters finished, so. But it's interesting that sister, who is my homegirl, because she's from Cincinnati, Ohio, would bring that up. Last year, I attended a General Relief Society conference with several black Latter-day Saint sisters. We were sitting there, and we thought, is there anybody up there that you really identify with? We were sitting in the big old, you know, the new conference center. And it only becomes an issue for me because it's an issue for somebody else, if you want to know the truth, because they won't let me be on a General Relief Society board because I have a three-year-old. Because I made an appointment with the General Relief Society board because we were all sitting there, and this was a concern of theirs. They wanted to know why there wasn't a black sister in representing somehow the black Latter-day Saint sisters. So I had a meeting with the General Relief Society board, and I asked that question. I took one sister with me because, you know, I'm kind of blunt and stuff, and so she keeps me humble. And the answer was that nobody had presented the names or something. And then they said to me, so do you want to be on the board? And I said, I can't be on the board. I didn't come here to toot my own horn. I came here to find out why there wasn't representation for every nationality in this church.
That's right.
We have now become, this is not a white Anglo-Saxon church. This has become a multicultural church. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, we need representations from all walks of life. So they just asked me to submit some names. So that was a year ago. And I submitted 10 names. So that's my
answer. Well, the Hispanic population in the church is huge. They should be represented.